really pleased to have Greg Grossmeyer here from the U of M Copyright Office. As you may have heard from things like the Google Book Search Project, U of M is really an academic institution that's at the core of what's happening with copyright and dissemination of information. And Greg is an alum of the School of Information, where my new office is, and we're so pleased that he's here today to give you sort of a one-hour primer on what can you do and can't you do with articles and images and music, so that when you go into the classroom, instead of feeling reactive or uncertain, you can feel confident about the choices that you're making. And we're really pleased that he's come to see us today and share that with you. So please welcome Greg.
Hello. Is this on?
Yes.
Good. We're recording this, so just so you know, if you ask any questions, they might be later on put online somewhere. So make your questions a little bit anonymized. No. So I'm Greg. I'm at the Copyright Office. We have our office over in Shapiro Library on the third floor. Well, first of all, can everyone hear me decently? Okay. Good.
A little louder.
Okay. I'll sit up a little bit straighter then. So yeah, we're on the third floor of Shapiro for now. We move up to the fourth floor soon, but we're pretty easy to contact. Our email address, which you can barely see there, is simple enough. It's copyright@umich. So if you have any questions now or later, go ahead and just send me a question. I'll be the one answering it, so don't worry about that. Oh, you figured out how to do it. Okay, so copyright. What is copyright? Well, according to the U.S. Constitution, I mean, it's in there. It's in the framing documents of the country. It's to promote the progress of science and the useful arts by securing for a limited time to authors and the inventors their exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. So it's right there in the very beginning. But what really is copyright? So it's kind of a bundle of rights. That's how people refer to it. It's the right to reproduce a work, right to prepare derivatives, distribute it, perform it, display it, and then any of those rights they can give to other people. They can give the right for other people to do those things. So I have the rights over all those things on my work, but I can also say, hey, you can do a couple of those things, or you can do a couple of those things only in certain contexts. So I can share the wealth in a way. But how do you get copyright? Or more grammatically correct, how do I receive copyright protection for my work? Well, it has to meet a couple basic requirements. It has to be original. Can't just copy something else. It must have some level of creativity. It can't just be pure fact. It can't just be like the length of this chalkboard is whatever, 40 feet. That is not protected by copyright. And it must be in a fixed medium, and that means written down in some fashion. So the drawing on your napkin, that's a fixed medium. Things on a computer, fixed medium, just not ephemeral. So me talking right now, if this wasn't recording, isn't protected by copyright. That recording is, however, and it's held by someone else other than me. So in the old days, to get full copyright protection, you need to do some certain other things too, like put the little copyright symbol on the date, and if you want even more, you can register with the Copyright Office. But nowadays, you don't have to do anything. That note you wrote to your friend the other day, protected by copyright, surprisingly. The little doodle on the bar napkin when you're drunk, protected by copyright. It's kind of crazy. And it's also instant. Like, as soon as you write it down, as soon as that doodle is done, as soon as your pen leaves the paper, so to speak, metaphorically, your fingers leave the computer, it's done. It's protected by copyright in the U.S. It's different in other countries, but that's how it works in the U.S. These are what copyright does and does not cover. So writings, choreography, music, visual art, films, and architectural works are explicitly called out in the Copyright Act. Things that are explicitly also called out as not being protected are things like ideas. So just an idea of something, you know, my idea for a character in a book, the way that that character talks and dresses and things, not really protected by copyright, but a specific expression of that idea. So my written description of them or my drawing of them, protected by copyright. Facts, just like the measurements of the chalkboard, not protected. Data, kind of related to that. And useful articles, things like a lever, that's protected by patent. Completely different. So copyright lasts for a fixed time right now. for at least the next little while until Congress changes it again. But right now, it's the life of the author plus 70. After that, it's in the public domain. And there's kind of some general rules you can live by about what's in the public domain and what's probably protected by copyright. So anything before 1923 is in the public domain in the U.S. Hard and fast rule. It's in the public domain. No chance of it being protected by copyright. Between 23 and 63, it's kind of this crazy, crappy gray area that really depends on whether they put that C there, if they put that C there and registered it, if they put the C there and registered and renewed it. I mean, it's like, I get those questions all the time and I dread them because I have to go look, and luckily Google has scanned all of our books in the university, so I can go and search these huge volumes of copyright registrations that the Library of Congress has and try and find the record for something being registered back in 1942 under a different name and bad spelling and things like that. So it's kind of a crappy situation. So if you have things in between those years, we can try and help you, but it might take a little while. And then things authored by the federal government are explicitly public domain. That's a special rule the United States has. Other countries don't do that, like the United Kingdom. Everything produced by the Crown in the United Kingdom has a Crown copyright, which means you can't do anything without getting their permission. Otherwise, but in the United States, everything like the laws, the congressional reports, things like that, freely reusable by anyone. Yeah?
Wasn't that the basis for the stamp tax and whatnot?
Stamp tax.
You had to have the Crown copyright?
Right. I don't know remember the details of that. I remember something about that, so you might remember more than I do on the stamp tax.
Sorry, history major.
Yeah. No, that's good.
Flag whenever something is historically relevant.
Yeah, there's a really weird history about how copyright actually came to be. It was basically from the UK. They decided, the Crown was like, well, there's these book publishers. They got their own thing going on. They have this guild of book publishers, and they have their own rules they live by. They're not laws, but they're rules. They're like agreed upon things. But then they realized that other people were producing, anti-government propaganda, or anti-Crown propaganda, and the Crown decided we should instate this thing called copyright, which means that we can censor people. So actually, copyright's initial purpose was censorship. Some argue today it still is, but that's up for debate. So there's the history of it. Now, the things that are in copyright is the opposite of what I just said. So after 63, it's protected by copyright, pretty much a hard and fast rule. 23 and 63, it depends. And then state and municipal works. So federal government is special. It's public domain. But City of Ann Arbor, all the stuff they produce, copyright City of Ann Arbor or Washtenaw County or State of Michigan. There's like three or four exceptions to that rule, and it's just because those specific cities decided to say in their bylaws that their materials are in the public domain, but it's not a federal or state regulation. So that's what copyright is. Now, what about infringement to copyright? So there's a good discussion we should have, though, about what is infringement and what is plagiarism. Infringement is basically the unauthorized reproduction of a work that is still protected by copyright. It just means copying, unauthorized. Plagiarism is different, but kind of similar, right? I mean, it's kind of like a square is a rectangle, but a rectangle isn't always a square. Plagiarism is copying someone else's work, but it might not be copyright infringement because it could be William Shakespeare. I might completely copy Hamlet, but and put my name on it, and it's not copyright infringement. I can't be sued by anyone. No one can take me to court or anything, but I will be looked down upon by pretty much everyone in the world. So that's a really important distinction to make because sometimes it gets confused. Question.
But both have legal repercussions, right?
Only copyright infringement. Plagiarism has legal repercussions only in the fact that, you know, a student can get expelled from school for it. But it's not legal in the sense that they'll go to court. It's
okay.
Just usually, you know, you sign something when you come to school saying, I won't do this. So it's contractual more than legal. Oh, never mind. All right. So then there's some exceptions to copyright law. They're not exceptions to the law. They're exceptions to the exclusive control that authors have over their work. So one is fair use. What it basically means is, it's an exception to copyright protection, that if you make a use of someone else's work that's still protected by copyright, but it fits into these four factors in a positive way overall, then your use is considered a fair use, and it's permissible. So the four things are the nature of the original work. So whether the original work was creative or factual. So something that is like, you know, a novel gets more protection, quote-unquote, than something like a description of some scientific thing. You know, like, barely, like, you're stating the facts, but, you know, it depends on how, like, wording choices can be a little bit different between people, but you're really just kind of stating facts. So one gets more protection than the other. The purpose of the use, so if your use of someone else's work is purely for commercial gain, you're not really... That part of the factor test would be negative for you. If, however, your purpose of your use is for educational purposes, you will be okay on that factor. Then the amount of the original work. So if you use the whole thing, it's bad. If you use a little snippet of it, better. And then the effect on the original market of the original work is, you know, if your use negatively affects someone else's ability to make money off their work. If it does, bad, doesn't, good. So then you have all those four factors. The judge will go through them one by one and kind of assign them a plus one or negative one, effectively, or zero if it's kind of equal. And then they'll add them up and decide on balance if your use is fair or not. In education, there's a strong weight for the purpose of the use. So we have a special thing, which I'll get to, about face-to-face and online education. So,
yeah, I was going to say, like, if you're doing a unit on art or something, it's kind of hard to just show one corner of the painting.
Right. Oh, right, yes. So then what you're doing then is, so I'm using the whole thing, so it's a negative against me, right? Mm-hmm. But what I'm doing with it, my purpose, is I'm making commentary around it. I'm, you know, teaching about this style or his technique or whatever, you know. And because of that context around that painting, my use will most likely be positive because the amount is negative, but the effect on the original market doesn't harm it. Purpose is positive. I'm using it for contextual purposes and teaching thing, while the nature of the work is negative. So it's negative, positive. But even though those come out to, you know, zero, it's still kind of weighted more for being positive because of the reason why you're doing it. That makes sense, everyone?
And this is important from the education, the K-12 perspective, because fair use is a term. You'll hear colleagues in your building say, I'm a teacher, so I can use anything. And there are some constraints.
Yep.
So that's why he's pausing at this moment.
Yeah. And then, so that's fair use, and that's basically, everyone has that right. Everyone in America does. It's an American law. They have fair dealing in the UK and things other places else. But we also have this relatively newer thing called the Teach Act. It's from 2002. There's an exception or exemption from copyright law, exemption from copyright protection that allows for face-to-face teaching and communication display of materials. And the Teach Act was basically modifying that to allow for distance education and online learning. But it only applies to performances or displays of the work, so displaying an image on the projector or showing a short video clip or a full video clip, but not like making copies and handing them out to you. A little bit different. There's some requirements for it. I'm gonna read through these really quickly. I don't remember them all the time, so sorry. But so basically it has to be a government body or an accredited nonprofit educational institution. It must also have policies regarding copyright some way. You know, it has, like, its public copyright policy for staff and students to abide by. It has to provide accurate informational materials regarding copyright, so just, you know, here's what it is, and then provide notice to students that materials used in the course may be subject to copyright protection. So when things are being displayed or given out to you, it has to be, like, warning, you know, may be protected by copyright, be careful. And then only for students officially enrolled in the class. Okay? So most situations in education, right? I mean, most schools have some kind of copyright policy. You probably weren't told of it necessarily all the time, but it's there. University of Michigan obviously has one. And me doing what I'm doing right now is doing the provide accurate informational materials regarding copyright. I go around and do talks all the time, so that meets that requirement. So fairly basic requirements for it. So you did all that, but what do you get? So basically, that's what it says in the law. The non-lawyer version is you get the right to performance of a non-dramatic literature or musical work as long as that work wasn't copied illegally. So if you came across a pirated DVD, you can't show that in class. Sorry. you have to acquire the DVD legally. And then also pretty much display of work in a face-to-face classroom is pretty much not an infringement. I pause there just because it's pretty much not an infringement. You get a lot of leeway. And a lot of times, even if it might be technically an infringement, you have to kind of think about what your risk analysis is. So lawyers always like to talk about risk analysis. Basically, that means you're going to do something. It may or may not be legal, but you have to weigh whether or not you really want to do that, whether the benefits of that outweigh the chance and likelihood of you being sued. So a common thing that law professors like to teach law students is, you know, you made a risk analysis this morning about coming to class. You decided that asteroid wasn't going to fall on your head in the morning on the way to work or on the way to class. So we're always making risk analysis. Yeah.
Question.
Yes.
YouTube. Assuming that we could get to it in the class.
Right. Totally fine. Totally fine.
Okay.
Yep. That's actually a really good source for showing educational videos or videos. As long as what you're doing, you know, has some educational purpose. You know, you're not just, like, showing the latest Disney flick because you want a day off. Sorry.
So can I put my whole school in the gym and then show Mulan as a reward for taking the MEEP standardized test of the SAT?
So that happens a lot.
Yes,
and
it does.
Right. and that's where that risk analysis thing comes in. So technically it's probably an infringement, but is Disney going to sue small little public school, you know, of second graders? Sometimes they do. True. I mean, there have been court cases where someone had painted Mickey Mouse and Daffy Duck on the wall of a playground for a daycare center illegally because they didn't get a license for it and Disney sued them. So it's all about weighing your risks.
Well, theoretically, wouldn't showing a piece of art or like a movie or something increase the market value of that item because it makes people want to then go buy a print or a copy themselves?
Yes, that could be a part of that fair use. So that's fair use, which is separate from the Teach Act. Teach Act is like these special exemptions for teachers, basically.
All right.
But fair, like, that's a common rebuttal for that market part of fair use, the effect on the market of the original. Even though it has a positive effect on some market doesn't mean that it's fair necessarily. It's if it has some kind of negative effect on some part of the market, like if your students wouldn't have bought that book, but just because you gave them the book, they might later in life enjoy that author more and buy more books by him. It's kind of a stretch of an argument. You know, they didn't buy that book for that one class, so it was kind of a negative effect. So, yeah. Images from a textbook?
Because I know textbook manufacturers are extremely obsessed about copyright.
Mm-hmm.
How's that
handled? So in that case, you are using something in an educational context and not the whole textbook. So that most likely is a fair use, especially if you're not using like every single image from that textbook. So if you're just using a few of them, you know, from one chapter or something, that is probably fine. What I should say about fair use, though, is the reason why I'm being kind of wishy-washy with my answers is because no one knows if something is going to be a fair use or not until a judge says it is or not. That's kind of the problem with fair use is there's no real guidelines. Like it says, you know, the four factors are how much did you use of it? Well, it doesn't say if you use less than 10%, you're fine. Because there could be a case, I mean, there was a case where someone used a paragraph from a full book. And the book was actually a factual book. It was a biography of a president. I think it was Kennedy or Nixon, one of the two, where there was some scandal during his presidency or during his election time. And campaign, thank you, election time, where, like, something came out later on, right? And this book was kind of like the coming out of that story. And the New York Times wrote a review of the book, but they also included, like, that climax part of the book, like, that really important bit of it. And even though it was just three or four sentences out of however many hundred of them, it was deemed to be not a fair use because it severely harmed the market for the book, and it reproduce the heart of the book, not just, you know, yet another paragraph from it, but the heart of the material. So in the case of a textbook, to bring it back there, not any one of those images is the heart of that textbook. It's kind of hard to find the heart of a textbook anyways. I'm not talking metaphorically here, but I mean just like, yeah, so in that case you're probably fine. Yeah.
Can you address for classrooms have document cameras, whether putting the image and projecting it without making copies or sticking it in a C-tools kind of environment. But how we act with that?
Those are probably, I mean, those are usually just like a new version of the quitter slides, right? Basically, I mean,
Like
you know, technically there's tons of copying going on all the time, but that one is just you making an easier display of the work. You could just pass it around, but doing it like that, no one is going to sue you for using one of those machines. I mean, the argument back in the day of when computers first started sharing a lot of material and the internet was there, people were like, well, there's a copy in the RAM, there's a copy in the hard disk and the cache, there's a copy on these servers in between your laptop and the server where it's coming from. All those copies are copyright infringement. No. There are ephemeral copies that there have been deemed to just be ephemeral, necessary for the purpose copies, even though technically they are full copies of the work and, you know, technically copyright infringement, it's fair use in effect. So, anything else in this right now? Maybe? Well, you can come back to it later. Questions about anything at any time, I'm pretty open to that. So, I just want to touch on this real quickly. So, there's a lot of copyright educational materials out there for free online from various sources that might be useful for educators to use when they are required to or want to teach about copyright to their students. Be careful if you're going to use some of that stuff. It's not as though the stuff that's from RIA and the MPAA and things of that sort are wrong. But just they have a particular side and a particular view of the topic. Don't want to say too much. I mean, I don't want to put them in a horrible light or anything. They're not lying to anyone. But their educational materials need to be taken with a grain of salt, effectively. So when you're teaching your students about copyright, if you have to, just be aware that some context needs to be put around these things and, you know, current cultural state of affairs do play a large role in what is permissible under law. So, just needed to say that. So, I mean, when you go and find all these educational materials, just be aware. Then there's stuff that the law hasn't really addressed very well, particularly sharing and how confusing copyright law really is. I mean, those 20 or 30 slides I just had are just the basics of three sections of the Copyright Act. There's about 20 of them. So copyright law is very confusing, especially in this new era when we have tons of different media creation, you know, people making music and movies and sharing photos and stories and, you know, different writings and, you know, dinosaurs. And back in the old day when you made something like a painting, you had a choice, a real one choice to make. You know, I can either give it to a friend, I can hang it on my wall, or I can sell it to someone, or I can put it in a museum, or I can do other things. But you can only do one of those things. Now, thanks to digital technology, we can do all of them, right? All at the same time. But as soon as someone receives that work, as soon as you receive that painting from a friend, the digital copy or the digital photo or whatever, your uses of it are restricted by copyright. You can't do anything with it. You can't then go show your mom or forward that image to your mom. It's a copyright infringement. And that applies to everything, not just photos, but movies and text and music and books and blah, blah, blah. But what if you do want to share? That's where this this organization Creative Commons came in. Does anyone know about Creative Commons?
I viewed the website.
You viewed the website. Good. So most of you have heard of it at least, right? So basically Creative Commons provides a set of legal tools that you can use as a creator of a work, as an author, the person that holds the copyright for a work, and tell others how you want them to be able to use or not use your work. So it has 6 licenses. We'll go through the different parts one by one. The male restroom symbol is attribution. Basically, it means you can do whatever you want, just attribute me as the source of the work. All the licenses have that. It's a universal part of them all, so attribution is always there. Then there's this concept of non-commercial, which basically means, in simple terms, your use of it can't primarily be for commercial gain. There's a lot of wishy-washy gray area in there, like, you know, what if I have your video that you license under non-commercial license and put it on my blog, and my blog has ads on it that I use to barely support, maybe not even completely support, the server costs for my blog. Is that a commercial use? Some would say yes, some would say no. So basically what I'm trying to say here is it's kind of the gray area of non-commercial licenses are not necessarily worth the effort if you are the creator of the work to use that aspect of the Creative Commons licenses. So I disrecommend using that module. Then there's this concept of no derivatives. So basically you can use my painting, you can share it with people, you can put it other places, just don't, you know, scribble on my sky and kill my dinosaur. Don't change it. I want it to stay the same forever, basically. And then there's this concept of share alike, which is kind of difficult at first, but it kind of makes intuitive sense in a second. So I had this original painting that I made and I like a lot, and then I shared it with the world under attribution share alike license. And then someone took it and they made some changes to it. They changed some colors and they added mountains and some trees. Their new painting, being based off my painting, has to now be under the same license as we shared alike under the same license. So now it's there available to the world under the same attribution share alike license. Someone else takes that painting and they make a derivative of it. They make it at night or whatever. That painting also now is under the same license. So it kind of ensures the freedom or ensures the license of the work forever, any new derivatives of it. Without that clause, I could take a painting that's under an attribution-only license, for instance, make a derivative of it, and then put it under an all-rights-reserved regime. So there's with those 4 modules, you can jam them together and get those 6 licenses. Yeah.
But how does the attribution work on that? Like, does each succeeding person have to go, like, inspired by X, inspired by Y, inspired by Z?
Ideally, yeah. Unfortunately. But luckily that doesn't happen. Like the chain doesn't get too long normally.
Okay.
I mean the average song or pictorial work is remixed on a chain no more than like 5 times. It's remixed a lot of times, but in different areas. Like if you have like the original work and you think of a new derivative as a new spindle on it, and then a derivative of that is another one, those don't get very deep. But sometimes there's a ton of those original remixes. So all those are just referencing one. They don't need to reference all the different derivatives. So did that make sense? It's the first time I did that little thing.
Scarily, yes.
Good. All right, so you have those 4, the 4 modules, match them together, you get 6 licenses. It's easier to think about them on a spectrum. So on the left-hand side, you have the public domain, no holds barred, anything goes, you can do whatever you want with it. On the far right-hand side, you have all rights reserved, which is you need permission to do anything, right? So that's where there was this big gap for a long time with Creative Works about, well, I want to share, but I don't want to share completely. So that's where Creative Commons came in, and there's licenses there. So on the far left, you have attribution only, attribution share alike, attribution non-commercial, and then non-commercial share alike, or attribution no derivatives, non-commercial no derivatives. So non-commercial no derivatives basically means you can use this just and share it, that's about it. You can't make any changes, you can't make any money, and you have to give me attribution. So there are those choices. And there's three layers of these licenses. The first layer that you'll see is the human readable deed. Basically, it's the part that makes sense to everyone else. It says, you know, this is the license, and you are free to, unfortunately, it doesn't come out too well on that screen, but you are free to share, and you are free to remix under the following conditions, that you attribute and that you share alike. So it kind of sums up this five-page legal document into basic sentences. But this is what actually makes these usable, is because they have a legal document behind them that is enforceable in the court of law. So if someone takes your work that you put out under a Creative Commons license and they do something that isn't permitted by that license, like they take your story and remove your name from it and they did not give you attribution, you can sue them for copyright infringement because they breached the terms of your contract. These are licenses, contract, fairly synonymous words. So, and then even behind that, sorry for the techie bit, but there's this metadata that can be associated with the work. So, warning. I did remove that stuff. All right, so there is this ability to embed HTML metadata within your web page so that search engines like Google and Yahoo and blah, blah, blah can crawl the web and figure out, oh, this photo right here is under this Creative Commons license, so that when someone wants to look for a photo of a flower under a Creative Commons license, they can find your photo of a flower that you have under a Creative Commons license instead of having to just be lucky and find your photo of a flower under a Creative Commons license. But what about public-facing student work, to bring it back? So the situation where you have your students make something like an audio clip or a video or whatever, and you're just using it as a simple assignment. Simple assignment, by that I mean not sharing it with everyone else. You know, it's the traditional, they create it, they maybe share it with their classmates and you. But what about something that they want to share online? Well, that's where things, Teach Act is no more, basically. Once you go online and behind and outside of the password-protected, you know, C-tools type environment, you're back to only be able to argue fair use. Teach Act no longer helps you. So one way to get around some of the questions and issues and problems of that is to encourage the use of openly licensed materials, Creative Commons licensed materials. If your students are making a podcast and they want to use some background music, blah, 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 use Creative Commons licensed music instead of the latest top 40 hit, which sometimes actually might be Creative Commons licensed in the case of like Nine Inch Nails. But most times they aren't, unfortunately. But that way, the students can use it and not worry about copyright infringement, not worry about the student or the school or the teacher being taken to court because they used 40 seconds of a song. You've done a bit of this, and what has your experience been on using like Creative Commons licensed music or not, or things of that nature?
I use Magnitude a lot because it's Creative Commons, but it's a little hard to navigate, and it's part of why I was pushing the idea of aviary earlier in the term, because it's got those loops built in.
Oh, okay.
You know the work's going to be shared publicly. GarageBand loops that are built in as well.
Right.
One less thing to worry about, and one less thing for your kids to be looking for.
Yep. Yeah, Magnitude. Yeah, Magnitude is good. Jamendo is good. There's all kinds of these like repositories of audio and video and other resources. I just have a couple here, and I have Google there, but not just normal Google. I mean, Google.com searches the whole web, right? There's the ability to limit your search in Google, like I was hinting to before, under the advanced search to only things that are licensed under a Creative Commons license. So when you go to the advanced search at the bottom, you have to like click a couple times, so they kind of hide it, unfortunately. But it's there. You can search the web via license. Archive.org has a ton of music and video, old like government videos, you know, things that are really kind of fun to make commentary with, like, you know, old nuclear testing videos. I mean, fun stuff like that is on archive.org. Fun, you know, whatever. Okay. And then there's even the website called PodSafe Audio that specializes in any kind of music that's available for use in podcasts. Because the podcast community kind of saw this as a problem, you know, way in the early days of, well, we want to use this audio, but how can we? So that's where they came in fairly early on.
We talked about archive.org in the summer as the place that had the Wayback
Machine. Oh, yeah.
You could find mm-hmm. old versions of websites.
Yep.
Which also we talked about in the context of just because the website is gone, the information may still linger somewhere.
Yeah. Can't ever really delete anything. Yeah, they do a lot of good stuff. Archive.org, the Internet Archive, they're one of those good organizations that just has a really solid public interest mission. Yeah.
Are you comfortable with sharing the PowerPoint?
Oh, yeah, I will. Yeah, yeah. I finished it, you know, right before I walked over here, so I didn't have a chance to put online yet. But yeah. Oh, yeah. We can share it with students and anything. Yeah. It is under a Creative Commons license. Yeah, everything that the Copyright Office produces, anything that the library actually produces, is under a Creative Commons license. Right now, it's the attribution non-commercial license. We're switching in the future, most likely, if things go according to plan, to an attribution-only license. So you'll be able to use anything the library has on their website that's produced by the library, not like the Elsevier journals, but the library guides and things of that sort. Freely, as long as it's created by library staff.
Two questions.
Mm-hmm.
One, if your kids just want to, if you make it clear that, you know, they can't go outside of the classroom with something, they can use any clip they want, right? If it's just for an in-class project?
For the most part, yeah.
Okay.
Pretty much. I mean, when we're talking about clips, it's the fair use claim on that is going to be really strong for the educational purpose within the classroom. The four walls of the classroom tends to be a fairly sacred area with respect to copyright and reusing other people's materials in educational ways. Yeah.
And then the second thing is, like, if we do end up giving our kids the lecture on, like, plagiarism and copyright and stuff, because, I mean, most people, especially if you're in an English and history classroom, do.
Right.
This is going to sound horrible, but do you advise us to be honest about the fact that there's technically no legal problem with plagiarism?
Yes.
I mean,
well, don't lie to them.
I mean, you can be sued if you plagiarize.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Not sued. You can only be... You can be sued for defamation. You can be sued for... you can't... So... The most common case would be if you use something of an author that's still under copyright, they will be suing you for copyright infringement, not plagiarism.
Right.
Yeah, because plagiarism isn't in the U.S. code. But then it's just like the more, you know, academic social norms that will take other actions against you.
In my
yeah.
book contracts, it says that I don't have even if I own the copyright for my book, I can't go to court unless my publisher agrees.
Right.
Because they get drawn into the court case as well.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, are we better off just saying don't do this because it's illegal versus don't do it because the academic community will look down on you?
Well, you can say don't do it, otherwise you're going to get kicked out of school.
Okay.
You know, I mean...
And I think copyright goes both ways. One thing that was effective for me was to talk with students about times that my work had been used without my knowledge or permission. And I think they tend to be, when you treat students like they are
right.
creators as well, they don't want their stuff taken without their permission or remixed without their permission either.
Right. If you make it a personal issue, they'll understand it. Yeah. All right. Okay, so now I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about what I'm kind of terming the new wave in education. So there's this thing called OER, which is Open Educational Resources. So basically they're educational resources made freely available and openly for anyone to use and reuse and remix and change as they see fit. So that's kind of the basic definition, but I like to define things by their boundaries, how they're the same or different from other things. So I'll go through a different, some other areas. So open access. Has everyone heard of the open access publishing movement? It's very big in the libraries, but we like to think it's a universal topic of discussion, but it isn't always. So basically, open access is sharing content, usually of scholarly nature, so things like scholarly articles and things of that nature, online for free, lowercase f free, just free as in, you know, no cost. And it doesn't require the use of an open license, like a Creative Commons license. Whereas OER is sharing stuff, but it has to be under an open license. And then, so in that case, OA and OER are friends. They kind of overlap a little bit. Open access is, you know, a bigger group of materials than OER right now, just because there's a ton of open access journals out there where scholarly articles are available for anyone to view and read without having to pay the big publishing firms, you know, $35 for one article. So then there's this concept or this movement called OpenCourseWare. It started with MIT back in the day, actually, in like 2002 or 3, I want to say, that focuses on sharing a complete, you know, course for others to reuse and remix. So MIT right now has their entire curriculum, all 5,000 courses, 5,000 plus, online available for you and anyone else to see and view and use and remix as you see fit. I mean, they're all under an attribution, non-commercial, share-alike license. But OER, on the other hand, is a little bit broader than that. So OCW is a subset of OER. OER is everything associated with education. So the good example that I like to give is, while OCW is focused on like the syllabus and the PowerPoints, OER is focused on anything that could be used in educational settings. So at the University of Michigan Medical School, they have this thing called the Eyes Habit, which is basically something like 800 images of eyeballs, like camera right here taking pictures of people's normal eyeballs and eyeballs that have issues. And they use it to teach medical students, you know, the different things with eyeballs, right? But it's not really an educational unit. It's not like a standalone, here, go run through this and learn everything to know. It's just a resource that teachers can use to make something like that, right? So that's online available from the University of Michigan Medical School under an attribution-only license so that other people can use those images and make their own medical education resources on eyeballs. So that's where the OCW and the OER are a little bit different. Then there's this concept of e-learning, which is basically electronic learning, you know, distance learning kind of things, like the system that steps you through the process, you know, read this thing, answer this question, did you get it right, move on to the next one, read this thing, answer this question kind of things. Those are, you know, educational resources, but they aren't always openly licensed. Many times they're actually closed and require payment. OER materials are kind of the things that could be used to be the building blocks of e-learning and e-learning resources. But you can also just make an OER that is an e-learning resource. Just slap a good Creative Commons license on it, and you'll be good to go. So in that respect, they're kind of friends, and they have an intersection. But okay, so enough with all that. There's other things out there, right? But why do you want to use or participate in OER? So this next few slides will go by pretty quick, and they're focused on higher education academia, but I think it's fairly universal. So we're here in academia, the ivory tower, full of people that look like that and like that, who write journals and books and write code and have data they create, and hopefully if they're doing their job really well, they have some decent educational resources. And all those things can and arguably should be shared, right? Why? Because we love to share. But really why? In academia, with the people that look like that, and hopefully teaching the people that look like this in a couple years, and write those journal articles and the books and that, and the source code and the educational materials, all those things that they made were built upon other people's things anyways. You know, you've heard it before, standing on the shoulders of giants. But it's not just academia. You know, those things are the way we build culture. We don't build culture in a vacuum. We build culture off of talking with our friends, off of watching videos on TV, off of YouTube, off of whatever. I mean, we are not an island. So it's kind of taking that logical idea to its conclusion of, well, let's just build with each other instead of building against each other with education. So there's a ton of resources out there. There's one right now that's actually in Utah that is an open high school that is doing its entire curriculum online under an open license so other people can use and reuse. This is their main course listing page for, I think, ninth grade, I believe. And it has, you know, mathematics and social studies and technology and all that stuff. And if you go to one of the sections on in their algebra course, they have, you know, videos they created that they show their students. And they also have, like, their lessons plans and the readings and all that stuff, all there available under an open license so that you can go and use it and fit it for your situation. So the goal of OER isn't to have, like, this one, here's algebra, because that one algebra thing doesn't work for everyone. Every student's different, right? So you need to translate that for your own local context, and that's acknowledged, so you can use these things and mash them and work them into your own way that you teach. So that's where the real power is. It's not just here's this canned thing. It's here's this stuff that you can use to make your own. Then there's also this resource called CK12, which has books and things of that nature for K through 12 studies, mostly focused on, right now, math and science, just because that's where a lot of resources already are, but it's expanding. Then there's even a resource here at the University of Michigan called Open Michigan. Full disclosure, I used to work there. So Open Michigan encourages researchers, learners, and instructors to maximize the impact and reach of their scholarly work through open sharing. So what I just said, right? I mean, the whole reason why I'm passionate about this stuff is by making this stuff available, people can do cool things. So this is their OER homepage. Basically, you can see on the left there all the lists of different schools that are participating right now at the University of Michigan, and some featured courses and things of that sort. So if we go to public health, which right now only has two main resources. I mean, the School of Information, as a early adopter of this stuff, has like 30 courses. The University of Michigan Medical School will have, by the end of this semester, the entire first and second year curriculum for their med students. So medical school, the fairly prestigious medical school, is putting their entire first and second year curriculum online. Third year is when you start doing like rounds and labs and all that stuff, so it doesn't really translate to online very well. But all that stuff is going to be online. So some of this stuff, so this specific course, Health Management Policy 607, Corporate Finance for Healthcare Administrators, very awesome course, right? You know, this is the homepage for it. They have the description, who the instructor was, and if you go to lectures, this professor chose to do a pretty cool thing where he has his slides that he has, you know, been making over the last however many years. It's a fairly renowned, a.k.a. older gentleman that has his slides fairly well prepared and knows the topic fairly well. So what he does is he does that on a video and puts it on YouTube. So the students, this is a, it's one of those classes where it meets like once every 2 weeks on a Saturday. It's for professionals, and you basically watch the video of the professor going through the slides on YouTube before you come to the class, and then when you're in class, that highly sacred time for these members of the class, the students, you actually have the interaction with the professor. You know, you use that time. You're not just listening to me lecture right now. I mean, what I'm doing right now is cool, whatever. You're listening to me talk. But really the important thing is this discussion that we're having, the questions that come up. That's the valuable part. So that's what this professor started doing. You just put the lecture up beforehand, then you get to class, and then you do the in-class discussion. And he likes it. I mean, he's a big proponent of this. So, but it's not just for his class, right? I mean, he's on YouTube. So if you go to some of his YouTube videos, some pretty cool, you know, responses. You know, thanks a lot for this series of presentations. You know, they're very informative and well done. You know, my teacher did not explain this as clear as you did. I mean, his stuff is being used. I mean, let's see. This one is almost 1,200 views. This screenshot is from last February, so almost a year old. And someone some 1,200 people decided that Finance and the Financial Manager was an interesting video to watch. Cool, right? I mean, it's being used. So there's stuff out there, and there's really cool things you can do. And if you want to do any of this, if you want to do this in the future, we can help. So with that, I'm done. Questions?
Chris, can I ask a quick
yes.
one? Actually, one is for Kristen and one's for
yeah.
Kristen, would you tell the folks why the thing why they're just talking about
it? Oh, we're recording it because, school librarians are constantly told that they're the copyright, then insert noun of your choice. Queen, diva, Nazi, police. And what's happening is that the movement of copyright has been changing so significantly that many librarians, and I think including myself, were trying to have a more kind of conservative view of copyright. And now we're really starting to see an institutional shift so that we're really looking again at how creative works are built on the creative works of others. And I think my end of the profession is a little bit not certain how to proceed with authority in this issue. So we had a couple of librarians who wanted to come today, but it fell, they still have jobs. So we're recording it so that it can be shared with them, which I did check with Greg beforehand. Because I don't think it does a service to have a profession that's out of date, because I think perhaps I could have been a little bit more liberal than I was when I was in practice.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough, too. I mean, you don't want to say something wrong and get someone else in trouble. So.
Right.
But it's hard to know the right answer a lot of times. I mean, like with the fair use, I mean, I was being wishy-washy because it's kind of annoying and you don't know the right answer. So, yeah. But, and with that said, I mean, if you do have any copyright questions, fair use, Teach Act, whatever, your specific use case, like I want to do this, is this kosher? Send an email to copyright at UMich. I'll answer it. Promise. Maybe not that day, maybe tomorrow or something, but yeah. So, honestly, my experience is very minimal. The most experience I have is with my mom, who was a nursing instructor for a community college. But, I mean, and they didn't run into much of this because they were doing everything in the classroom. And I think the problems arise just when you start doing things publicly. You know, I mean, it was a great use of technology to let students communicate with their peers publicly without the mediation of the teacher, you know, blogs and videos and podcasts and blah, blah, blah. That really helps, but that's when you start running into some issues. So just the basics are what's all that's needed right there, really. Encouraging the use of Creative Commons licensed stuff and, you know, knowing that your stuff is going to be online for everyone at archive.org. So being aware of that.
I can add
yeah.
something to that. Also two mistakes. One is the book was written by a teacher, so I can use anything out of it that I want. And one is that we forget that students hold the copyright to their work. And what I'm seeing is there's these big trends for all student work to be put on wikis and to be published publicly, but really that right belongs to the child or the student and not to us.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things right now, like the chemical engineering school, like all, they have students actually write the textbook on a wiki. But to do that, they have to get the permissions from the students, because as a student, your stuff is owned by you. Even faculty, everything the faculty create at the University of Michigan is, the copyrights are held by them. It's actually part of it's a confusing thing with the copyright policy here, is when you sign as a faculty your employment contracts and the whole like slew of things you sign when you become a faculty. There's one that says everything that I create is the university's. And you're like, what the heck? That's not what I thought. But then in the policy, it said, you know, yes, we take it, but we grant it right back to you. So it's kind of confusing. But faculty hold their stuff. Staff don't. Staff that are doing things just for their work, like, you know, normal work day responsibilities, those things are, the copyright are held by the regents. And so that's the distinction. Yeah.
As far as copyright,
yeah.
And where some school districts are actually qualifying student work as media, and so it falls under the old release forms that it's either done with an opt-out or an opt-in policy that says my kid's picture can be in the paper, And they're saying, well, if you sign that your kid's picture can be in the paper, we were vague enough, we didn't say the paper, so it could also be online, it could also show up in a video. I think there's a huge legal underground volcano that's starting, and I think parents, there's going to come a point that something's going to go online that parents don't like, and then it will be addressed. I think most districts have not caught up. I think most acceptable use policies have not caught up, and they mostly deal with things like don't download bad stuff, and they're not really dealing with these issues of intellectual property and permissions. Most parents are a little bit so excited that their kids are online. There's a great parent perception that technology presence means quality of education, and so most parents are kind of a little bit starry-eyed about it right now.
Well, that might have something to do with, like, pictures of kids, but I'm thinking, like, if you're posting a kid's work online and the kid says it's okay and then the parent sees it online and doesn't want their kid's work online,
I think
who holds that copyright?
If I were you, I would take it down. I don't...
Well,
I think at that point, the issue... I mean, if the parents and the child disagree, they'll figure that out at home. The copyright... There is no age limit on copyright. The copyright is held by the student. But, you know, the parent kind of does have some sway, and they can raise a stink. So just to make sure things are kosher in school, I would remove that. And the parent and the kid can figure it out. You can help.
But you'll run into situations like custody arrangement or witness protection or that works for the FBI or as a public official where there will be some kind of backroom conversation about whether that student's work can be on.
Yeah. Privacy is not related to copyright, but it can trump it sometimes.
And Greg, you mentioned before, Chris, and you know, you've got experience with this too, when you talk about sharing work digitally, beyond the four walls, where the TEACH Act is fully in place, et cetera,
right,
where things are pretty well protected, that you talked about a password as being a key element as well, that sort of buys you a lot of protection.
It does,
I want to make sure that was clear to everyone.
Yeah.
That something work exposed,
It's basically, in the law, you know, it says only to students that are, you know, registered or whatever the word is for that course. So, like with C-Tools for the course, it's based off the registrar's information and you use your U of M username and password. So, with those two bits of information, we can be fairly certain that only students enrolled in the class get access to the material. You can do makeshift things if you don't want to use, you know, C-Tools, or if you don't have a C-Tools equivalent in your school, you can do other things and just make it available, some technological measure, so that other people can't get access to it. It doesn't need to be an officially university or school sanctioned system. It just has to be limited somehow.
In reality, your search engines can't go behind those password protected things, and no one's ever going to know what's behind your wall either.
Yep. Yep.
Or post on the open web, someone can search and find it.
Come on.